Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 22nd, 2004. Today's session number is BRM 2004-09. Today's speaker is Mark Brocker. The lesson for today is Bonhoeffer Conspiracy and Imprisonment, Sharing in the Sufferings of God. Let's listen in.
And I am Mark Brocker, and our theme today is sharing in the sufferings of God. Sharing in the sufferings of God. This is a particular phrase that comes from one of Bonhoeffer's letters, and I will read that a little later in the presentation. But we want to just really focus on what does he have in mind with this notion of sharing in the sufferings of God. And it has a lot to say then about his understanding of who God is and where God is located in our lives. And I think you'll find this provocative and maybe even inspiring. Just some words of introduction. He had a personal experience of suffering in prison. I think we need to take that into account when he's writing about sharing in the sufferings of God. He's in prison, and he was arrested in 1943, and so he basically had about 2 years, just over 2 years of time where he was in prison. Not always in the same prison. It was in the Tegel prison the longest, but 2 years of prison experience. And the basic elements of his what we might call his theological understanding of suffering, actually we can find earlier in his writings. And but what happens is, in a sense, then he goes through and begins to experience them, and it deepens his understanding, because he's experiencing that which he has been reflecting on and talking about in a very personal way for him. I think it's fair to say that it's not so much he came up with a brand new understanding of suffering, but his prison experience confirmed and deepened his theological insights into suffering. For him, in this, I've been repeating this in one way or another, it was axiomatic that human suffering needs to be understood from the standpoint of God's self-revelation in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. So you're going to look at anything Bonhoeffer does, you always have to somehow take into account that fundamental revelation in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. I'm going to develop this primarily from his letters and papers. So these are various letters he wrote to, like, Eberhard Bethge. Some of the most of this is to his dear friend Eberhard Bethge, that where we'll be drawing stuff from. And he did a lot of very provocative theological thinking in these letters. And sometimes you don't get it all worked out, you just get these allusions along the way, or brief paragraphs, or even it might be two or three sentences that's very provocative. But that's where we're taking this from. There's also some poetry in here that he wrote that's very interesting, and we'll refer to some of that as we go along the way. The fundamental question, he says, and again, this isn't a brand new question, but he just states it very clearly here in letters and papers from prison, is the question is, who is Jesus Christ for us today? And that's a question that he believes is one that needs to be addressed in every time and place, in terms of people. In the community of faith, and as a Christian who's following Christ, you have to ask, who is Jesus Christ for us today? And he realized in prison that what we would consider pat religious answers simply were not adequate to address the kind of suffering that he himself was experiencing, and that many others around him were experiencing in an even more extreme form. And then we think of all the suffering that was part of World War I and the actions taken by the Nazis. There's a wonderful passage in one of his last letters where he lifts up the importance of meditating daily on the life, sayings, deeds, sufferings of Jesus. And he's talking very concretely the importance of doing that for people of faith, to focus in on Jesus on a daily basis. Suffering for him is an important, but it's not the key to his theology. And I think at times, and especially with someone who's in prison suffering and ends up getting hung, it'd be very easy to just make suffering the key to interpreting Bonhoeffer, interpreting his theology. It is very important, as we shall see. but it's not the key to interpreting his work. It's important to think neither too little nor too much of suffering, and there's a balance there. Suffering is one part, an important part, of our human experience and God's experience, but it's not the only part. And interestingly enough, one of the things that he will discover, and we're going to talk more about this, one of the things he begins to discover in prison is he wants to look at other aspects. He gets back to the Old Testament even, because he wants to look at the fullness of life and all that goes into life, and not just make suffering the key, but to look at how even the, even when we exercise human strength, how does that tie in with the kind of life that God intends for us? Our focus then is what Bonhoeffer thinks. We are going to focus on what he thinks theologically about suffering. It's his thinking about suffering. To ask the question another way, how does God's revelation in Jesus Christ interpret our human experience? I think it's very important. We're not just starting with our experience, but we're asking the question, how does what God has done in Jesus help us interpret our experience? Also, he wants to avoid turning suffering into some kind of abstract principle here. And very important. So it's, again, we need to take God seriously, and we do need to take the world and our experience seriously, but keep those together. And he wants to look at both personal and corporate dimensions of suffering. The basic point, then, that I've going to unpack is that the Christian life involves sharing, and this is the translation of a key term for him, unreservedly in the sufferings of God in the world. And so we'll try to get a handle on what does it mean to suffer unreservedly in the world with God. I just alluded briefly yesterday to two concepts that he develops in Letters and Papers from Prison. If you ask the question, who is Jesus Christ for us today? In a personal sense, in terms of a personal form of Jesus Christ for us today, in Letters and Papers from Prison, he uses the term Jesus as the person for others. Then, so if you were unpacking that, just briefly I'll do this for you. What would it mean to, if you're going to look at the life of Jesus, to live as a person for others? And he uses a phrase, Jesus was there for others. Being there for others was a key phrase that he lifts up. And there is a whole, and I'm not going to go through all this, but it's a wonderful passage where it talks about all the different messianic sufferings of Jesus. And it doesn't just mean like pain, but all that you go through, it's all that Jesus was engaged in on behalf of other people. And that's a whole range of things. And he has a wonderful, looking through various biblical references in the Gospels and so on, various ways that Jesus gave his life for others in his, during his ministry. A second thing would be to ask them, what does it mean to die as a person for others? And the cross then, and from this standpoint, becomes the final supreme act of being there for other people. And it's the consequence of being there for other people. It's a consequence of his way of life and his obedience to the will of God. And it becomes a very direct challenge to our self-centered way of life. And then he has a passage where he says, Christ helps by his suffering and weakness. That's how Christ helps us. And I'm actually going to read that passage a little bit later. In terms of resurrection of the person for others, he says the resurrection confirms that being there for others is God's way in the world. So it's a confirmation of the life and the ministry that Jesus lived out. It is God's yes. He uses that in quotation marks. It's God's yes to Jesus' way of life and this way of life in the world. And then he says something very striking. He says that resurrection drives human beings back to life on earth in a wholly new way. And I want to read a passage for you on this, because I think this is, I don't know about you, but when I grew up, I had the sense that the resurrection was about finally, when all is said and done, and you die, finally you'd be relieved of suffering and you'd be able to get away from this world with sin and evil. And so that was what eternal life was about. Finally you'd get away from all of this, and it would be a wonderful life with God. And he has a different slant on this for us. He says, the decisive factor is said to be that in Christianity the hope of resurrection is proclaimed, and that means the emergence of a genuine religion of redemption, the main emphasis now being on the far side of the boundary drawn by death. Now he's talking about kind of view I grew up with here. But it seems to me this is just where the mistake and the danger lie. Redemption now means redemption from cares, distress, fears, and longings, from sin and death, in a better world beyond the grave. But is this really the essential character of the proclamation of Christ in the Gospels and by Paul? I should say it is not. The difference between the Christian hope of resurrection and what he calls the mythological hope, that's the one that I'm saying, the traditional one I grew up with, is that the former sends a man back to his life on earth in a wholly new way, which is even more sharply defined than it is in the Old Testament. And then he goes on, he says, the Christian must drink the earthly cup to the dregs, and only in his doing so is the crucified and risen Lord with him, and he is crucified and risen with Christ. This world must not be prematurely written off. In this, the Old and New Testaments are at one. Redemption myths arise from human boundary experiences, something beyond life, but Christ takes hold of a man at the center of his life. I think what he's taking seriously here, and again, that's all, it's not like we have this all developed further for us, but he's saying in terms of the resurrection of Christ, that isn't intended for those of us who are still numbered among the living. That's not meant to, in a sense, remove us from taking care, carrying out life and ministry. That's the love for the world should, in a sense, this resurrection is meant to drive us back into the world, to care for this world that we're still a part of. Put another way, our death and resurrection is yet to come. And so to prematurely write off the world and just focus ourselves on this wonderful life we're going to have after death, and use an ethical term, he would see that as simply irresponsible. Very self-centered, I think, is what he would say. Very self-centered way of approaching things. We may want to talk more about that later, but I wanted to lift that up for you here. One other place, as he says, only if we love life and earth can we believe in the resurrection. Only if we love life and earth can we believe in the resurrection. Then to sum this up once more, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus as a person of other, for others, reveals God's sufferings in the world. The life of Jesus reveals the image of God as suffering servant. The death of Jesus reveals God as weak and powerless in the world. God is pushed out of the world onto the cross. The resurrection of Jesus reveals that God, though, will ultimately overcome suffering and death. So it has that hope that suffering and death will not be the final word for life. God will be able to overcome it. But here and now, God still suffers in the world. And he has another striking passage where he says, only the suffering God can help. And let me just read a brief portion of that for you also, so you get a sense of how he talks about this. It says, God lets himself be pushed out of the world onto the cross. He is weak and powerless in the world, and that is precisely the way, the only way, in which he is with us and helps us. Matthew 8:17 makes it quite clear that Christ helps us not by virtue of his omnipotence, but by virtue of his weakness and suffering. And here is the decisive difference between Christianity and all religions. Man's religiosity makes him look in his distress to the power of God in the world. God is the Deus ex machina. It's kind of the, how do you say this? It's what you bring in when you have no other answer. Then God is the answer. The Bible directs man to God's powerlessness and suffering. Only the suffering God can help. To the extent we may say that the development towards the world's coming of age, and you know, we haven't been able to read all this, but it's what he talks about in the first part of this letter, has done away with a false conception of God. It opens up a way of seeing the God of the Bible, who wins power and space in the world by his weakness. It's a very, very provocative point there, but again, trying to take seriously how it is in this sinful world, how God, in fact, and he's very much focused on Jesus. You know, Jesus goes to the cross, does not look like a powerful figure hanging there on the cross, and yet that the events of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection have profoundly altered the course of history. Just in fact, it has done that. We're not talking about just a nice idea here. It has, in fact, altered the course of history. He also then, in terms of the corporate form that Jesus takes, in letters and papers from prison, he talks about the church as the church for others. And I mentioned this yesterday when we were talking about the renewal of the church. Again, being there for others is the life principle of the church. It's how the church is built up by action, where it takes seriously this being there for others. He said the church is the church only when it exists for others. That's why it exists. As the body of Christ, the church shares in the sufferings of God in the world. In a suffering world, the church, servant church is willing to suffer for others as Jesus did. The servant church makes the sufferings and burdens of all human beings its own, and very much there, think of 1 Corinthians 12:26. One person suffers, we all suffer. One person rejoices, we all rejoice. He's picking up on that sense of interconnectedness and seeing that not only in terms of just within the church, but in terms of all of humanity. The church, he views, as only the beginnings of life in community with God and our fellow human beings. It is the realization of God's will for community in the suffering world, so it's the beginnings there of what God intends. The church, he says, belongs in the middle of the village. And the church is called then to participate in this community with God by sharing in the sufferings of God in the world. And then he also acknowledges that the broken community or the community of sin is still present in the church. We're always dealing with it. It's an imperfect world, and in an imperfect world, sin will be present. Just as Christ is present in, with, and under, sin's going to be right in the thick of things, too, for the church. So the identity of the church does not depend on being perfect. You know, the real church has to deal with the presence of sin in the world and in the church itself. Now, to move more directly to the theme of sharing in the sufferings of God, and I'm actually going to then talk about sharing in the sufferings of the community of God, because we're really talking about Trinitarian is God, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Spirit, and then we're talking about a real participation of human beings in that community of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Jesus then, the person for others, reveals that the purpose of God's sufferings is to restore community with God and with our fellow human beings. It's God's intention to establish his rule in the midst of suffering. Okay? In a suffering world, limitless serving. So serving takes the form of limitless suffering for others, because there's consequences too. When you serve others, there will be consequences. And again, suffering can be take many, many different forms here. You know, in terms of the way you actually experience it, could be physical suffering, it may be emotional, mental suffering, even spiritual suffering, rejection by others, and so on. But it goes, it's just the nature of it. When we live in this kind of world, and especially the situation, imagine he's in prison there, he's experiencing this very directly, to be a servant church will entail suffering for others. He has a wonderful quotation where he talks about Christians stand by God in God's hour of grieving. So if you think of what's going on and what was going on in Nazi Germany, I mean, his image of God, very prominent image, is God is grieving. God is grieving with what everything that's going on here. Christians, therefore, are called to stand by God in God's hour of grieving. And then he talks about the concept of metanoia. That's a Greek word, but it's sometimes translated as repentance. Or it's a Greek understanding of conversion. I think he has a very striking understanding of conversion. You know, one version of conversion that I learned going through high school was, you know, you need to accept Jesus into your heart, and then you're converted to Jesus in that way. And I remember in Portland in the early 70s, there was a Maranatha church, and I went there a couple of times, and the whole thing was focused on getting young people to accept Jesus into their hearts. And that is one way of understanding conversion, but I want to lift up a different way that Bonhoeffer comes at this. He says, that is metanoia, not in the first place thinking about one's own needs, problems, sins, and fears, but allowing oneself to be caught up into the way of Jesus Christ, into the messianic event. And then he says, thus fulfilling Isaiah 53, which is the suffering servant chapter there in Isaiah, perhaps the most famous of, there's different servant songs in Isaiah, but that Isaiah 53 is the one about, you know, his stripes, you know, and the, this image of a servant who's really suffers and is mistreated and so on. So he's, well, how he understands metanoia then, or conversion, is it's a conversion from a self-centered attitude to a focus on God and the neighbor. So getting the focus off of ourselves and focusing on God and neighbor. In a sense, it's to become a suffering servant, and in as much as we become suffering servants, we end up participating in the servant church. He views suffering as a way to freedom, and he says deliverance consists in our being allowed to put the matter out of our hands into God's hands. So when we're finally free to just to live out this servant life and, in a sense, accept the consequences that come our way, that is freedom. And he does talk about death being the crowning of human freedom. Another important concept for him then is the this-worldliness of Christianity. That's the best we can do in terms of an English translation of the German. But if you think of other world and this world, he wants to really stress the this-worldliness of Christianity. And Eberhard Bethge in the documentary mentioned a letter, and he said, I think this is the most important letter. This is what Eberhard Bethge says, and he talks about this-worldliness in this particular letter. And again, this was written... this letter was written the day after the failure of the final attempt by this conspiracy group. Their final attempt to assassinate Hitler, it had failed, and this is what he writes on the day after that failure of that. And this is where he knows that basically it's probably over. You know, but it from this point on, he knows things are going to unravel. And so you can imagine you'd be very reflective at a moment like that, when you know that your life is probably going to be over soon. He said, I have discovered later, and I'm still discovering right up to this moment. Must be the sand pile there.
Why don't you just close the window? Just close that too, smart.
Okay, he says, I discovered later, and I'm still discovering right up to this moment, that it is only by living completely in this world that one learns to have faith. One must completely abandon any attempt to make something of oneself, whether it be a saint or a converted sinner or a churchman, a so-called priestly type, a righteous man or an unrighteous one, a sick man or a healthy one. By this worldliness, I mean living unreservedly in life's duties, problems, successes and failures, experiences and perplexities. In so doing, we throw ourselves completely into the arms of God, taking seriously not our own sufferings, but those of God in the world, and watching with Christ in Gethsemane. And he adds here, that I think is faith, and that is, he uses again, metanoia. Again, to focus again, not on ourselves, not protecting our own security, but living out life. And it doesn't mean you're trying to get killed. You simply immerse yourself in the life that God's called to live, and you accept the consequences that come along with that. Earlier on in the Letters and Papers from Prison, there's an essay, and I alluded to this essay earlier in the week, called After 10 Years. And it's not clear, you know, it's kind of hard to figure out where to put this essay, but I think it's just, even in the new edition, we'll stay with Letters and Papers. But there's a wonderful passage in here where he talks about the view from below, the view from below. He says, there remains an experience of incomparable value. We have for once learned to see the great events of world history from below, from the perspective of the outcast, the suspects, the maltreated, the powerless, the oppressed, the reviled, in short, from the perspective of those who suffer. The important thing is that neither bitterness nor envy should have gnawed at the heart during this time, that we should have come to look with new eyes at matters great and small, sorrow and joy, strength and weakness, that our perception of generosity, humanity, justice, and mercy should have become clearer, freer, and less corruptible. We have to learn that personal suffering is a more effective key, a more rewarding principle for exploring the world in thought and action than personal good fortune. This perspective from below must not become the partisan possession of those who are eternally dissatisfied. Rather, we must do justice to life in all its dimensions, from a higher satisfaction, from whose foundation is beyond any talk of from below or from above. This is the way in which we may affirm it. In Latin America, there's a movement called Liberation Theology. You may have heard reference to it along the way. Gustavo Gutierrez is one of the leading theologians in this liberation movement. And that was very much an effort to do theology from below, from the standpoint of those who are poor and oppressed. Gutierrez just marveled that this German, okay, from an upper class family, would have come to this kind of perspective. This was a marvel to him. He didn't have it all worked out, but he truly marveled at this. This is written, though, before Bonhoeffer's in prison. So, the perspective only gets deepened when he's arrested and ends up in prison. Another key point here, then, is that in the way that he understands the sufferings of God, that God is truly in our midst. And so he really wants to lift up the nearness of God. Again, I don't know what your background is in terms of the kind of theology you grew up with. And my dad was a pastor, and so I'm not blaming this all on him. I'm just saying along the way in my Lutheran churches, you tended to get the sense that there was this image of God being out there, and God is all-powerful, all-knowing. This is the kind of image we had of God. And he's really challenging that understanding of God and said, we need to focus on God as God has been revealed to us, and God has been revealed to us in Christ as someone who is in our midst, suffers on the behalf of others, dies for us, is resurrected, and again, that resurrection isn't meant then to get us out of that, but to send us back into the world in a new way. And so he talks about God even as the transcendent, the transcendent one who is in our midst. He is at the center of life. And then he talks also then the neighbor, again, it's just hard to translate these terms, but the neighbor is very clearly then, God is present in the neighbor and appears to us in the neighbor. And think again of Matthew 25, 31 through 46, inasmuch as you've done it to one of the least of these, you've done it unto me, the sense that God appears incognito, we might say. Hidden God appears in our neighbor who is in need. And so he's very much picking up on this understanding of God. And so if God is in our suffering neighbor, then where do we need to be? We need to be there with God and sharing in those sufferings of God who's suffering with our neighbor. And in terms of what's going on, think of the Jewish people and why he would be so concerned. Well, given this theological perspective, God is with the Jews who are suffering and being persecuted and exterminated, and so that's where we need to be, because that's where God is. That's how God, in a suffering world, God is going to be suffering and grieving, and we need to stand with God in those places. And just practically speaking, then, in terms of the life of the church, I think I mentioned earlier in the week, we have a really good food bank at our church, and that's a good thing, and we're helping out people who are in need. And in that sense, we're sharing in the sufferings of God, you could say that, but consciously, the way we tend to think of that is, we're helping these people, but we don't necessarily see that as a part of how we're interacting with God. We may be doing what we think God wants us to do, but the idea of encountering God in our context, in our encounters with other people, that's a more difficult perspective for us. And the danger of even when you're doing something as good as giving people who are hungry or food if you miss Christ's presence in that other person, you miss God's presence, you see, there's a real sense of loss of judgment.
I have a story.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Do you want to tell it now?
Along this line, yeah.
Yeah, well, do it right now.
I did confirmation classes with kids, and we took food down to serve at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in downtown Seattle. And what Maynard, the pastor, did was to require us to go out and sit and actually take a meal with the folks who were serving.
Okay.
Instead of just serving the meal.
Yeah, yeah.
So you actually talk to folks and find out. I met a guy there that was a rocket scientist, literally. Mm-hmm. It was alcoholic and had gone downhill from that.
Yeah.
So it made it a different sort of giving when you go and participate with the people you're serving.
And again, the concern is it's participation in the sufferings of God, but we're talking about this is, it's waking up and opening our eyes up to this community that we're a part of, and to see them, this person's not just somebody that you're helping, but it's someone who's part of God's community, and that's how we participate in community in the fullest possible sense. Want to just briefly bring up then, before we open up for conversation, a notion of the fullness of life. As much as he emphasizes suffering and sharing in the sufferings of God, he also in prison is discovering the need to attend to what he called the fullness of life. And this is where his increased interest in the Old Testament took place. He had a real love of the Psalms. One of the reasons he loved the Psalms is because the full range of human emotions and experiences are lifted up in the Psalms. There are Psalms of thanksgiving and praise. There's Psalms of lament. There's bitterness expressed. There's Psalms where thanksgiving for what God has done. Just a whole range of human experiences in these Psalms. And the other thing that he said is that really dawned on him, and he was really reading the Old Testament much more. I think it surprised him, but this is that he wanted to read the Old Testament so much while he was in prison. But he said, people of God do all sorts of sinful behavior in the Old Testament to the glory of God. And he even, this is a striking term, but he actually says this, they even fornicate to the glory of God. And not, again, it doesn't mean that the fornication is, it's still sinful behavior, but the fact is God is able to take these human beings that do all sorts of crazy things, and God finds a way to work through them and accomplish good in the world. And, I mean, think of King David, commits adultery and, does repent and so on, but he's still allowed to stay in that position as king, and so God's still working through him despite his shortcomings. And I've actually did a sermon one time on the genealogy of Jesus. I can't remember if I took Matthew's or Luke's. I mean, how boring did you get, the genealogy of Jesus? Oh. But what I did then is just lifted out a few of the characters in there and talked about, look at these people that were part of Jesus' genealogy. And I mean, there's some murderers and liars and adulterers. I mean, it's quite a cast of characters in there that God manages to work through. So he's really trying to take into account how God can work even through human beings with all their foibles and limitations. And I thought the sermon at Vespers was last night on Jonah, wasn't it? We heard last night. That brought this up very clearly. Whether Jonah liked it or not, God accomplished what God needed done through Jonah. And Jonah, he wasn't willing, he got angry, he wasn't happy about what happened, and God still managed to get the work done that needed to be done. He also, my wife's favorite verse or passage in Letters and Papers from Prison is this one. He says, he said, we need to focus on the fullness of this life and not get ourselves focused on the life to come. That'll come, but now we need to focus on what it means to live life in all its fullness here and now. And he said, it's a bad taste for a man in his wife's arms to be hankering after the other world. It is bad taste for a man in his wife's arms to be hankering after the next world or the other world. She loves that one. She likes to remind me of that. Another way to say this is we need to discover and love God and what God actually gives us. What actually is here, and this whole sense of gratitude for the life that we've been given. And this is a guy that's in prison writing this. I mean, this is striking stuff that he can see this even in the midst of his own personal suffering. He also talked about broadening his understanding of the various mandates or responsibilities that we have. And he thought, I've mentioned marriage and family and work and things, the state, you know, being a citizen and being involved in the church, and those are all, he says, in the sphere of obedience, things we need, we're obligated to do. But he starts exploring the notion of a sphere of freedom, which include art, education, friendship, and play. So really a broadening of his perspective on what is really entailed in the fullness of life. And he says, and even in difficult times, Christians need to be able to devote themselves to both of these spheres of obedience and sphere of freedom. We need to recognize God in the center of life, in both life and death, in health and suffering, in our activities where we're doing what God's calling us to do, and even recognize God's presence when we're engaging in sinful activity, that God is still there in all of that. He is, those of you who are musical, he has this image of polyphony of life, and he talks how the love of God is the cantus firmus, he says, for the fullness of life. I think this is like the key, the melody line. I'm not a music person, but it's the melody line that continues, and then you have all the other aspects of life are in relationship to that fundamental love of God, and then all of this works with that, and that kind of music, I guess you'd have variations on it, but there's this melody line or the tone that follows through in the music. In terms of then, just finally, contributions of Bonhoeffer's concept of suffering. What is it that he really contributes to us that may be very helpful to us? Again, just the fact that he develops his concept of suffering in light of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and really tries to show how that's connected. He affirms the need to see the world from below, from the perspective of those who are suffering. A third one is he takes suffering seriously, but does not make it the key to understand all of life. And so very, very important in our Lutheran tradition that we have theology of the cross is important, but at times we stress theology of the cross so much that I think we do forget maybe to do justice to a theology of the incarnation and a theology of the resurrection along with a theology of the cross. As central as the cross is, we still need to look at the fullness of God's revelation. Fourth is he explores both the individual and corporate dimensions of suffering. I think that's important for us to do in our lives of faith. He seeks to avoid simply lumping all suffering together. So there is suffering that is consequence of our actions that we take. And there's other suffering that, who knows why we're suffering this way, we just do. And so we need to be aware of various kinds of suffering that we engage in. Number six, he highlights the nearness of God. So that we don't look for God in the by and by, so to speak. We look for God here and now, we look for God where God has revealed God's self to us. And this whole this worldly emphasis, I think, is a real contribution, and certainly his thoughts about the sufferings of God helps to bring that home, this worldly emphasis. The final thing I want to do is read a quotation. One of the last letters we have that he wrote to Eberhard Bethge, and there's a wonderful passage in there that puts this stuff together. This is dated August 21st, 1944. So he's the plot failed in July, so this is about a month after that plot has failed. It's a month after that letter that Bethge thought was such an important one. It'll be another, 8 months or so before he is hung, but you know, we don't have a lot after that at that point. But here's what he says, and this one I actually translated myself, so it's in here, but I wanted to translate it because there was couple of key points to bring up. It is certain that we may always live close to God and in the presence of God, and that this life is a whole new life for us, that nothing is impossible for us because nothing is impossible for God, that no worldly power can touch us apart from God's will, and that danger and affliction can only drive us closer to God. It is certain that we have nothing to lay claim to, and yet everything to be prayed for. It is certain that our joy is hidden in suffering, and our life in death. It is certain that in all this we stand in a community that sustains us. In Jesus, God has said yes and amen to it all, and this yes and amen are the firm ground on which we stand. Remember, he was told his conspirators, we have no ground to stand on, but finally he's saying, this it's the ground of faith in Christ It's our participation in this community of God. This is the firm ground, finally, that we have to stand on. And our confidence in God's presence with us, and that God will be there with us in a sense. By faith, we know God will be there for us, no matter finally how life unfolds for us or death comes to us. Comments, questions?
Interesting that he was willing to commit murder for the sake of Christ.
Yeah, but he didn't, not with an easy conscience, I guess. It's striking. It's why the, I was commenting, I don't think it was during a session where everybody was here, but I had three students, Quaker students, in the first class I taught at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, and who went through this, very much appreciated Bonhoeffer, his discipleship, his, just everything he stood for, his integrity, his courage, and so on, but they simply could not understand going to the step, engaging in a conspiracy. That was beyond what they could even conceive.
Difficult.
Yeah, and it's different than somebody just, saying he's not, they weren't saying he wasn't patriotic or any of those kinds of things that got thrown at him in Germany, but it was just, it's just not what you do as a follower of Jesus. You don't get involved in that kind of thing.
He had to come to a conclusion, I assume, that somehow God was not working in Hitler or not working in the Nazis. I mean, maybe I misunderstood, but I thought that part of the thing he was saying is that God works in the neighbor. God is in the neighbor. God is in the friend or the other people, the other things. And to pick up on that, that must have been an amazingly difficult participation in that type of a conspiracy, not a conspiracy to overthrow or anything like that, but the murder itself.
I shouldn't say for a Bonhoeffer, but I remember I had a professor at the University of Chicago named Jim Gustafson, who once made kind of a shock value, just said, basically every person is a child of God, and so there's a fundamental basic love you need to have for every person that goes beyond no matter what they do. And so he said, I even say my brother Adolf Hitler, even though he would criticize everything Adolf Hitler did, and the level of evil and so on. But you finally say, this is still our brother, even though completely misguided. And so I think for Bonhoeffer, obviously, it was not a revengefulness at that point. He was beyond that. This is not to say that along the way, he and his family, you can just imagine their frustration that this guy has come to power, is able to maintain power. But finally, to engage in a conspiracy would have to go beyond, for him, beyond revenge and hate. It's something else at that point.
What do you know of his interaction with Delft, with the Jesuit, and the impact of the Jesuit on him?
I don't know any specifics on that. I don't know that they were in conversation with each other. An interesting question. Something like that, I wish Abraham Bethke was still alive, because I haven't run across anything that lays that out directly.
That may be correct.
Yeah. They're connected in being involved with these conspirators, but whether they were really conversing with each other, I don't know for sure on that. He did spend time early on in, before he was in prison, though. Some of his best times for writing the ethics were when he was staying at the Etal Monastery. And so he had connections with Catholics, but that was not a Jesuit organization there. Benedictine, actually.
At what point in his life did he write The Cost of Discipleship?
That was written in time, actually ended up getting published too, when he was in the Finkenwalde Seminary, mm-hmm. And he actually did lectures that became The Cost of Discipleship in the seminary. So that's 35, 36, 37.
So long before, although Hitler had already come to power.
Yeah, but before he's involved directly in the conspiracy. In fact, the letter that, let me just add something here for you. The letter I said that Bethke considered the most important letter, and it had about living unreservedly. And I started where it says, you must live completely in this world. You must abandon any attempt to make something of oneself. In the paragraph before that, he actually says this. I remember a conversation I had in America 13 years ago with a young French pastor. This is Jean Lasserre, who was the pacifist. Okay? So he said, we were asking ourselves quite simply what we wanted to do with our lives. He said he would like to become a saint. And I think it's quite likely that he did become one. And I really begin to die. I saw the documentary, you know, I saw that they had a conversation with him, and I think he just was a wonderful person, you know, in that way. Although we as Lutherans, you know, we'll say everybody's a sinner and so on. But this guy really was, in many ways, what we would think of as an exemplary person of faith, and one you know, you model yourself after in a way. At the time, I was very impressed, but I disagreed with him and said, in effect, that I should like to learn to have faith. For a long time, I didn't realize the depth of the contrast. I thought I could acquire faith by trying to live a holy life or something like it. I suppose I wrote The Cost of Discipleship as the end of that path. Today, I can see the dangers of that book, though I still stand by what I wrote. So this was his own, you know, assessment of that book. John?
I just had a thought. I've listened to several of your lectures. I've missed a couple, but part of the link for me, at least in my own personal experience, which is certainly not his, but living with people that have suffered, his time in Harlem and with the AME Church, I wonder if that was the mustard seed that was planted that later bloomed and became the big tree you have on board.
You know, it's hard to say exactly, but I think it clearly sowed seeds for him. I
mean, the emotional stuff.
I mean, it's not shortly after that that he, you know, he alludes to this experience he had where he began to read the Bible in a new way. Now, he doesn't say that was triggered by my involvement at this church, but still, I think that was a key event for him in terms of then just waking him up to some things that he wasn't necessarily aware of. He might have talked about them. You know, it's one thing to talk about, you know, he's a excellent student in that, so he's reading things, and he has done reading of the Bible, but there's something about that experience that really seemed to trigger a lot for him, because that's also the year he meets this John Lasserre and really gets interested in the Sermon on the Mount. He goes to the Abyssinian Baptist Church, and he's dealing with African Americans. Reinhold Niebuhr and others are talking about social action. And even another good thing was for him to see all of these, what you might call signs of life in the church, but also then say, but they don't do theology well enough here. And so you can almost see him thinking, how do I put together these signs of life what I'm seeing here with good theology? And how do I do both of those? He also was more oriented toward academic theology, and really throughout you see him moving more and more into pastoral kinds of ministry, and I don't just mean the pastor, but that whole practical side of the faith and living out the faith seems to be more and more of a pressing concern for him. Doesn't want to throw out theology, but gets a little suspicious of just ivory tower type academic theology. But is also critical of social action in the church that has not well grounded theologically. You got to have both.
I think one of the issues that many of us as Christians have difficulty with is understanding the suffering of people whom we know and care about, and why they suffer. That's difficult. I have a brother who died of leukemia, and people have said that they would say to Paul, why you, Paul? And he would say, why not me? He had more understanding than others of us about the suffering. Yeah. But we have a number of members, every congregation has members who suffer, and you wonder, why?
Yeah.
What can you do to help? How can you participate in it with them?
Well, one response to that might be, and then when we talk about listening to people, but what does it mean to try to understand the world from the standpoint of someone who's going through, whether it's leukemia or going through family difficulties, or for Bonhoeffer then being in prison, all of a sudden, you know, it's going to come light bulb. What is it like to be in prison? And that's where he's, and in prison then, he seems to be very helpful to a number of the prisoners and even the guards, because you know, he's right there with them, and he seems to be attentive to, and he's experiencing life in prison for himself too. Go ahead.
I drive each week for our visitation pastor, our home congregation, and I'm always, after each time, I'm always interested and impressed with how differently people look at their own illnesses and suffering. Some carry it off very well, and some are, you know, the cup is always half empty.
Yeah.
And the variation in how people react to their own illnesses is, I just don't understand it, I guess. It's, but he's very good at what he does, and he doesn't understand it either. We've talked about it. It's just one of those things.
I'd be interested to get reactions from people, but I've come to a conclusion over the years that for a lot of people, just knowing in their hearts and minds that God is present is often the most important thing for them. Yes, you'd like to be healed from various illnesses, but a lot of times it can look simply like it's not going to happen. I mean, it's just the reality you're dealing with. And but it's the sense, I think people almost fear being alone in their illness more than the illness itself. And I'm not speaking for everybody here. It's just an observation I've made that whole sense of God's presence, which fits very much with here, he's really affirming God's presence in the midst of all of life. And I think that's a critical insight. It's, in a sense, it's not brand new. It's just the way he brings it out is in a striking way.
When I'm reading more about the story of Ruth, and they talk about loss and grief, and it forces you into looking at life differently. And so, you know, in their story, that's all they had was God. But I think going through suffering makes you look at life differently.
In particular, if you're willing to go through it.
Right. You have to go through the grief first, and then reassess your past.
Yeah.
And move forward.
I have observed some remarkable people in my life who were in tremendous suffering, tremendous tragedies happening to them. And it's almost as if that's given them a gift to relate, to teach other people. I mean, those that are, if you're around somebody like that, it's something that nobody else can teach you. And you look at those people and you say, yeah, there's something amazing to that person. There's a love, there's an understanding, there's a humility, there's a faith, and it's an incredible teaching position sometimes, many do not, but every time I've seen somebody like that, I go away and say, wow, you know, and it changes my viewpoint towards them of going in there and being sorry for them, as to why him, to, my goodness, what they have been able to give back, and you don't see it a lot, but you see it enough that it's remarkable.
Yeah.
But then there's the suffering of the Palestinian church, the Palestinians, who are losing everything, their whole existence, their whole way of life, their land, their water, their hope of a future. What would Bonhoeffer say to them?
Well, I think, in a sense, he might, better than we could, God would be grieving. I mean, that would be the first thing he would say, and you'd resist as you're able. You know, I mean, he did finally try to resist the evil that was happening, but, I mean, he really saw Germany going down the tubes. I mean, that was what was going on there. And but you can't, there's no easy answer to that, since you can't give an easy answer to that. Because, I don't know, just think of personal experiences. If you've had a personal experience of severe suffering, you know, people, they may, you know, they'll try, but any tried answers just don't do it. But this the idea of sharing the suffering, God grieves, but it doesn't mean that we just kind of, you know, if you're in prison, he's really in a position where he can't do much more than that. See, at that point, you've lost your ability to affect any kind of change and to have any major resistance to the evil. And so you finally, in that situation, you suffer under the evil. But he's, you know, obviously he did not say no to all resistance, but there's not an easy answer to that. And especially if you're talking, we have to be very careful about giving trite answers. So even though I'm talking about this, you even got to go in and say, well, God is with you. You even got to be careful how you say that. And it's funniest thing I've had is some of the most grateful expressions of people who've been sick, you know, when I visited, been when I haven't said hardly a thing. You know, you show up, you maybe offer communion if they want communion, and the people, it means something to them, but in some way, it must communicate the presence of God to them. And it doesn't have to be the pastor, it can be a concerned person, whoever, and almost, you do need to be ready to speak if you need to speak. See, I'm not saying that you don't say anything, but at times, literally just going there seems to make more of an impact than anything you can say.
I work on a crisis line in Seattle 2 days a week and take calls, suicide, domestic violence, etc., and we listen. And what I've learned by being here in Holden is in simply listening, you're giving that person grace. Mm-hmm. And mostly they'll figure out their own problems.
Yeah.
Just a voice to listen to, it's a remarkable gift to give someone.
Yeah.
Isn't it Bonhoeffer, I think you said in an earlier session, that said Jesus is always calling us to death? I don't know if that was from your session or somebody else.
Yeah, it's in the documentary, too.
It's trite for me to say that. It's not so trite for him to say that, because he's got an experiential base, like the Palestinians, to say that. And my question related to that was, when you were talking about Jesus being the person for others, not exactly serving, suffering, but being called to, I heard two things which to me, well, I thought I heard two things which to me seemed different. One was that at the crucifixion, Jesus is a person for others at the crucifixion, and he said that's the result of being a person for others, that's the result of living as a person for others. Did you want to come down one side of that or the other? I mean, because part of what I think Bonhoeffer might say to the Palestinians, because it was his experience, is living as the church leads to death, and Christ is, by Christ's very example, the result of being the church or the people for others can well go this direction. It's not right, but it's part of the very experience of being to the heart and suffering of God. But my question was the difference between the result of being the person for others as opposed to being the person for others. My professors are saying insufficient Christology here.
Yeah. Well, I would say his crucifixion is, he does want to acknowledge that in other words, the goal is not to suffer and die. But suffering and death is a consequence of being who God's called Jesus to be, and being, you know, and I think he's influenced by Philippians 2:5-11 there, and humbled himself and became obedient even unto death. I mean, that's going on there. So it is, in that sense, it is a consequence of the life that he lived. And he's trying again to put, there's the life you live, which can include suffering, but that suffering may even take the form of death. You don't seek death, but you accept death as a consequence. I don't know, does that answer your question, or still,
I think it helps. I mean, because that's, I was thinking of the Palestinian church, and any of us who, in our calling, when obedience calls for death. Mm-hmm. That's why it's trite for me, because that's not been my calling, but I think for him, or for Palestinians, they can articulate for the church, this takes me to the heart of God. And in this pain is my joy, and in this death is my resurrection,
yeah.
or our life. But only they can give that witness.
I mean, and if you're, I'm thinking on a real experiential level for him, Bonhoeffer, there are times, you know, he's struggling with a sense of being alone, abandoned, deserted, and he's a human being. And so for him, this becomes, no, God is with me. I mean, that's to give you strength to keep going in that kind of context, a sense you've not been abandoned by God. Although Jesus then, you know, the haunting words on the cross is when he experiences abandonment by God. I mean, that's, and if Palestinians feel abandoned by God and the church there at times, that who would we be to throw stones at them or say, oh, you shouldn't feel that way? Or if somebody's suffering from cancer and they really truly are going through a time of feeling abandoned, oh, you don't try to talk them out of that. That would be very trite again, do that, because that's, again, I think this is why he's reading the Psalms too, because in the Psalms people lament at times and they feel that God is not there for them, or how long, oh God. I mean, this is all part of the fullness of our experience with God, and in a sense God's love is and grace is strong enough that it frees us even to lament and feel abandoned by God. So that's the other thing I'd pick up on here is I think one way of taking Jesus' crucifixion, you know, into our hearts and minds, and one impact is, I think in a real way, that's meant to free us up to take risks we might not otherwise take, to so that we might engage in action. And that could even impact us in relationship to a situation in the Middle East, where we would be freed up maybe to do some things that, you know, so we're not just protecting our own security and so on. Now, that doesn't mean that we all are going to do that now, that that's the one thing, because there are many different places to respond. But a real sense that when we understand what God is up to, that we're willing to take some risks we might not normally take. As individuals and as a church. And as a church. Last word? Anybody have one?
Just an example of about the care and of others and how you can get comfort. We have a woman in our congregation who has a very rare form of cancer, like 1% of all cancer patients, they don't really know what to do for her. And she was down getting a transfusion a month ago before treatment started, and a woman said to her, "How long have you known about this?" And she said, "A month." And the woman said, "I was a basket case for months. How can you be like this?" And she said, "I am upheld by the prayers of my congregation." Huh. And she felt that, yeah. And she has been very positive. But that she said, "I can just tell that you're praying for me, and that's your comfort."
That's interesting. I'll let this be the final word. 21, he writes his dissertation. And again, you know, this is before Hitler's in power, you know, and then the prison. He's a privileged family and so on. But he talks in there about the three things we can do for one another, and as living out, giving of ourselves for other people, that kind of action, which he says the self-giving love is right at the heart of who we are as a church, and intercessory prayer is one of those three. Forgiveness is a second, and then, you know, actions on behalf of others, and where you're taking another action, helping them and so on, be a third, but very much at the heart of that, and so yeah. You know, this is, again, when he's 21, but that became even more real for him in prison. And he said, it may be that the church will be reduced because of circumstances to righteous action and prayer. That may be what we're able to do. Because you might even, because he realized it could come a point where government would not allow you to worship or do anything that you normally think of as church activities. And so what do you do in that context? Well, they cannot stop you from praying. I mean, this is, you know, they cannot stop, and they can't stop you in prison unless they're literally have to watch you every second. They can't stop you from kind word to your fellow prisoner. You know, if you have any ability to connect with other people, they can't stop you from engaging in some kind of action of that sort either. And so that's, so that may be the nature of things for us, that that's what we can do. Well, thank you. If you want to add, till dinner, I'll hang around a little bit if you have other questions. And then tomorrow, last session, I think we're 10:45, and we'll look at the question of Bonhoeffer as martyr. And what I also do, this will be the presentation itself will be a little shorter, probably 20, 25 minutes. We'll have a chance to discuss the question of Bonhoeffer as martyr. But I also like, for those who come tomorrow, I'm always interested to find out what's something that just stands out for you this week that you learned from Bonhoeffer, an insight or highlight, something like that. Or it could even be something, I appreciate this, but I am still wrestling with this. I don't understand this about Bonhoeffer, something that stands out in that way. And I don't make, you know, we won't go around the room and say, now it's your turn to do this, but we'll open it up and give anybody who would like to share that with the group a chance to say something. And that really is a lot of, very helpful, I found it, to get, you know, what stands out for people when you've gone through a week like this. See you tomorrow, everyone. Thank you.